Hello, I'm Soumi Aryan. I'm the founder of the think tank for women in business and technology and the FemPeak platform with the mission of raising women's socioeconomic status. Let me open today's podcast by telling you about my obsession with shoes, high heels and stilettos in particular. Don't worry, you haven't come to the wrong place. This is indeed a podcast about women in business and technology. Bear with me, as it will all make sense when I introduce you to our guest today, Justine Southall, who was until recently the director of Marie Claire magazine and also served as the MD of Cosmopolitan magazine before that. I've often been baffled by why I love the look of high heels when I feel so uncomfortable with them and the psychology of this man-made creation, excuse the pun. Justine and I start from the heels, but then we make our way up to the different social and cultural norms and structures that impact women. Justine became a very dear friend of mine since she appeared in my 2018 documentary, The Millennial Disruption. We always have super interesting debates and don't always agree, but that's what makes our friendship all the more interesting. And I'm delighted to share one of our conversations with you on this podcast. When I see you going into a meeting, I've noticed many times that you were wearing your trainers coming to the place, and then you would arrive and you would change into your high heels.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, your Louboutins. So,
oh yeah.
So tell me, why was it that you felt the need? See, now this is coming from somebody who loves heels, right? I love heels, but I want to hear from you. Why was it that you felt the need? Or maybe not the need, but why was it that you cared about changing into heels? You know, I've seen many times, actually, I've been in conferences where women, you know, come in flat shoes, and then when they're about to go on stage, they change into heels. So where does that come from? Because I always think that there's something about heels that makes me, you know, on the one hand, I really like the look of them. And I think, but then I ask myself, why is it that I like the look of it? Is it because there's something intrinsically beautiful in it? Or is it because of some association with, you know, being desirable and looking sexy and all that stuff? So, because in reality, wearing them is very uncomfortable. That's why you would wear, you know, something like more comfortable shoes, and then you arrive and change.
Yeah, change.
So would you say that in maybe many cases that women feel the need to change into something that may make them uncomfortable to look a certain way? Or so tell me about the psychology of the heels.
So I think it's more than just the heels. I mean, if you look at female fashion, you know, over, you know, many, many hundreds of years, a lot of female fashion, things that have been designed for women, are incredibly uncomfortable to wear. You know, corsets or, at the kind of extreme end of it, women couldn't eat, they could barely breathe, they used to pass out, you know. I mean, it was like, you know, there's some pretty extreme kind of versions of this for women. And, you know, and there have been some pretty extreme male fashions as well, but they don't generally have the same levels of discomfort that female fashion has. And a lot of that is around creating, I think, a kind of, almost like a caricature of the female form. So, you know, whether that is, you know, a great big sort of, you know, padded push me up, stick 'em out bra, or actually implants now, or whether that is, you know, something that nips your waist in. Now with all the kind of stuff around hips and bums and having a great booty, you know, there's like, you know, there's it's about this sort of almost like this exaggerated form. Now, the thing that a heel does, so these are kind of two separate things. The thing that a heel does, if you take that particular line, is that, you know, it creates a different gait, doesn't it? If you can wear heels and do wear heels, it makes you stand differently. Certainly I know when I'm also very little, you know, so a pair of heels makes me physically bigger, you know, and more visible, less like a child. You sort of present yourself differently. Now, you know, is that because we as women want, you know, we enjoy that and we like that sensation? Is that because, you know, it's something that we've been kind of exposed to and taught to, you know, use to our benefit, or, you know, we've been kind of marketed to over, you know, who knows? But undoubtedly, you know, female footwear, that kind of stuff we're talking about, is, you know, it's a hell of a lot more uncomfortable than men. Men, you know, wouldn't consider wearing something that, you know, is excruciatingly difficult to walk in and gives them blisters and makes their arches hurt. You know, that comes with, I think, all the historical kind of expectations around how women look and how they dress. And I don't think, you know, I don't think you need, but I also don't think we need to unravel it to that degree. You know, whether you wear heels or not, whether you choose to look sexy, whether you wear a suit or a, you know, whether you wear masculine clothes, incredibly feminine clothes, I don't really care about that, because that's a choice. That's a sartorial choice. Some of it's societal. A lot of it is just that's, you know, fashion's fabulous, clothes are wonderful. However you feel you want to look to make you feel at your best and most confident, then I just say go for it, whatever that is. You know, you've got extreme examples. I mean, God knows, look at Dolly Parton over in America, you know, doing what she's doing. I mean, she's an incredible campaigner, but I mean, she couldn't be more archetypally sort of feminine, and, you know, in everything about her is the antithesis of, you know, a woman trying to present as a man, if you like, you know, in a masculine way, and having that sort of very clear definition of power. But she still, you know, she has the money and the position to make an enormous amount of change. I think if you are a woman and you are in a very male-dominated business or roles like political roles, then you have to be mindful of the way that you present yourself to give yourself the best chance of absolutely creating trust and credibility and authority. You don't find wrongly that the way you dress undermines that expression of who you are. So, you know, again, when you look at what, you know, the Biden-Harris campaign, and you look at the way that Kamala presents herself, she always looks incredibly feminine, gorgeous. She looks, you know, fabulous, but she's, you know, been doing the white suits and the, you know, so there's an element of, you know, yes, I'm kind of putting on this persona that is a classic male persona, but I'm doing it in a very feminine way, but I'm not distracting you with anything else other than my message, because in that arena, in that role, you just need the strength and clarity of what you're going to say to come first, rather than people wanging on about what kind of, you know, footwear you're wearing, which of course people will, because, you know, the press and media love to obsess about the way that women dress in power, particularly women in power, and use it as a tool of, you know, to undermine their credibility.
So while we are on that topic of look, let's talk about age as well. Do you feel like do you feel like the media and you know, the press and you know, generally the public are incredibly unforgiving of women for their age?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's,
how,
you know,
can we change
again,
that?
Ever been thus? So, I mean, I think that what we're seeing now is a very interesting moment in a lot of Western societies, where you have a substantial number of women hitting a certain age that would be considered to be pretty old, because they are that group of women that were coming through and kind of breaking into you know, wider career paths and, you know, media and other kind of, you know, other areas. They are the generation, very much the generation that I'm part of. I mean, you know, we kind of call it midlife, but I mean, you know, let's hope it is. But I think for me, definitely, I'm beyond that point. But, you know, those women that are coming into a more mature point, 40, you know, mid-40s, 50s plus, but are still visible, because they are part of a generation that expects to be heard and have fought for the, you know, the positions they have attained. And we're seeing far more of that, creating a dialogue. Those women are creating a dialogue around really trying to, you know, try to have a different narrative of what it means to be a woman and to get older. Now, that's not to say that you're not interested in looking the best you can look, being as fit as you can, being healthy, continuing your career if that's your choice, making other choices actually if that is something, you know, but those voices are much, much more prevalent now. And so I feel hopeful that, you know, we will see and continue to see a shift in that kind of abandonment of women, you know, over a certain age. Truth is that, you know, if you were to look at Hollywood or you're to look at, you know, most popular media, women, you know, they, you're not going to be seeing women securing those lead roles over the age of about sort of 35, 40, because they, that there is an expectation that younger women will come in. So you start to see them get character roles and everything else or sidelined completely. There is still a massive, massive inequity in terms of women who are in those roles as directors, as, you know, all the things we know about the film industry. Nonetheless, there is more visibility for older women.
I've noticed even on dating sites where, you know, much older men allow themselves to pursue much younger women, but they dismiss, you know, women of a certain age. They don't even look at, you know, they wouldn't even give them a, you know, a second look. And I think that that's definitely got, you know, it's got a lot of negative impact on, you know, on how women view themselves or are able to secure also career roles. You see, like, for example, I remember when Theresa May was in office, people were really nasty about her. You know, like, people would make comments about her necklace, you know, her look,
her shoes,
you know,
her up, yeah, all
you know,
that,
and
yeah.
I'm like, look at Boris Johnson. I mean, he's not exactly the epitome of great look, you know.
No, you're absolutely right. But I mean that does continue, the kind of media obsession with all, you know, certain you know, national newspapers and their obsession with the way that women look and how they dress. That, you know, that kind of, that hasn't abated at all, and that will continue. And I'm not suggesting for a minute that those sorts of prejudices around women and age have in any way gone away. They most definitely haven't. But I think you just have to keep, you know, it's just really important that women who are older make themselves heard. And also, you know, it's not 20, 30, 40 years ago, you know, which is not that long ago, you know, you hit a certain age and you just sort of kind of disappeared into the shadows almost, didn't you? And I look back at my grandparents, or not necessarily by my grandmother per se, but there's a kind of acceptance of aging that we don't have. Now, that's partly because they're incredible, you know, surgery and everything else that can keep you looking youthful, but it's not really about looking young. It's about saying, actually, I'm still visible, I'm still here, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not just going to, you know, I'm not going to put on my elasticated beige trousers and head off into the sunset, you know. And actually, ageism, whether that's, you know, women, I think, confront it more acutely, but men do confront it too. And, you know, the increase in men having various forms of surgery that help them to look, to continue to look youthful, you know, it's increased exponentially, because we're a culture that you know, follows youth. We're still obsessed with youth and what youth brings, rather than a culture in which wisdom and age and experience and all of those things are more prized. You know, in Eastern cultures, there is more, I think, more recognition of the value of those things. But we, you know, in the West, we've developed a culture where youth is, you know, very much held up as the pinnacle, isn't it?
I think it's everywhere. I mean, it's human society. And it's even more so now with the prevalence of, is that the right word? Prevalence of virtual reality, and, you know, and 3D characters that look visually like really stunning, but it's like, you know, it also puts a lot of pressure on young women. Like, now there are companies in Silicon Valley that are creating virtual reality, you know, influencers. And I think it puts a lot of pressure. And there's because there's so much focus and emphasis on looking a certain way and behaving a certain way, I feel like there just isn't enough headspace for women to be able to go and really focus on intellectual growth and other aspects of, you know, human experience, because there's just so much pressure on them to present themselves in a certain way.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I'm not sure that's really changed. I think the platforms that we see it on, and maybe the exposure of that is far greater because, you know, it's kind of more visible, but actually that's no different than it's been. And actually there are plenty of industries or areas where, you know, how you look is less important. And you know, we're very much, you're in an industry that is, everything is about, you know, it's all about how you look, how you sound, how you, you know, because your whole raison d'etre is to create moving images, to create films, to create, you know, and to, so that's absolutely at the forefront of your world, really, in the same way that it, you know, was in mine through magazines and websites, and then, you know, beauty companies that I was involved with. All of it's to do with, you know, how you look and how you present yourself to a large extent. There are industries where that is much less important. I think my concern would be that if within other spheres of academia, or, you know, of research and development, or any other, you know, areas, that actually the kind of insidious influence of that kind of how you look affects your ability to, you know, that's just another blocker for women to get in, you know, in industries that are already incredibly, have very low percentages of women in the first place. But I don't think, I think a lot of this, you know, is it that much worse? Is it? I mean, it's all, I think it's about the exposure to it, and and the you know, all the things that come with what is a kind of incredible, you know, obsession with self, really, and how, you know, that is very much exaggerated through those social media platforms primarily.
That's why I like LinkedIn, because it's by far much better. But even on LinkedIn, sometimes I see things I'm like, okay, that doesn't really belong here. Mm-hmm. But you know like in general, yeah, you know, like places, yeah, like Instagram and TikTok, you know, you go in and it's like, it's just basically showing lots of you know, the algorithm seems to really put more emphasis on and show more of women training their butt, you know, yes, and that kind of thing.
Yes. How much? I mean, it's just astonishing how much of that stuff is out there, that particular one.
Yeah, but why don't I see more images of women who are making impact in science and, you know, in like technology, right? So we need to change something there. So one of the things that I've been working on with the think tank and, you know, the platform we are building is like, you know, basically I'm thinking that we need to make sure that our algorithms are not based on rewarding engagement, you know, because I think we put too much emphasis on engagement, and in a way, actually, I don't necessarily want people to come to the platform. I know it sounds weird, right? I don't want them to come to the platform unless they really need something. And when they come there, I want them to be able to find what they're looking for easily and not, you know, spend a huge amount of obsessed time, you know, there. It has to be a place for genuine networking and, you know, growth. And, you know, I want people to come there to find resources that's going to be helpful to them. And in order for that to happen, you need to have a business model that's not based on and relying on advertising. And the world that we live in, you know, like, for example, a platform like Facebook and Instagram, you know, even LinkedIn, you know, Twitter, they just can't not have that form of engagement obsession. And that's why the algorithm is designed to feed you more and more of something that's like hypnotic and will keep you there, right? I think there is definitely room for revolutionizing these things. And I think that maybe that's the kind of thing that may come out of women. One thing that's really been an interesting observation is that a lot of people think, when I talk about, you know, the think tank and the platform, a lot of people think immediately that it should be a, or it is a nonprofit. And I'm like, no, it's not nonprofit. Why is it that whenever a woman is creating something, you know, there's the think tank side of it. Yes, because the think tank is like, I said it will be free, it will always be free.
Yeah.
You know, so joining the think tank is all. But the platform itself, it has to generate income so that it can support itself, right? And
yes.
And it can grow and benefit, you know, create benefit. Yeah, exactly. So I think instead of thinking about nonprofit, maybe we should think about like, you know, business for impact, you know?
Yes, but also businesses for, you know, sustainable businesses, looking at the way that women, you know, have been the expectations around this whole kind of nurturing thing. And that doesn't, you know, men and women are different. We do operate differently. We should celebrate that. That doesn't mean that women can't be as ambitious, as successful, if not more so, in the fields they choose to inhabit. But actually the means of getting there is, certainly in my experience, are different, you know, and the behaviors are different. So what you're saying is, actually, let's create a platform in which women's talent can be exposed and expressed in a completely level playing field, if you like, but also let's take those characteristics of being a woman and being female that actually are kind of sidelined into very much into kind of, you know, family and relationships and all, but actually, you know, let's look at businesses where those kind of characteristics have been really taken on board and the success that they have. And, you know, that has been well documented, hasn't it? You know, from the kind of command and control patriarchal kind of way of running a business to a much more inclusive, collaborative, you know, all of those things. I think that, you know, there is a difference between the kind of if you like, the mantra and the reality of actually doing it, you know, and that's a whole other conversation. But I totally agree. So how do we make it happen? Well, we make it happen by creating leadership and organisations, both, I think, through a combination of, I'm loosely calling it legislation, but, you know, expectations around inclusion that include women, and, you know, and actual diversity of the workplace. So that has to include, you know, that has to include gender, that has to include race, that has to include all of those things, alongside organisations basically being incentivised to do that and or told they have to, you know. I mean, it's going to be a combination of stick and carrot, surely, that
but
gets
also,
us there.
The thing is, like, my motto in life has been never wait for organizations, never wait for the government, you know, just I go out and I mm-hmm. break things and you know, make things happen. But a lot of it also comes down to women themselves understanding and supporting when other women start such movements and you know, try to do something like that. Like I've got some comments, some you know, responses to the whole movement from women saying that, oh, so you're building your business, like you're doing it. And I'm like, you know, how, I think sometimes there's no understanding of what it takes. Like, say, for example, each of these conferences has got 18, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15 people on the panel, right? The amount of work that goes, I actually have a team here getting paid. Like, I've got 5 people in my team that are working full time. Doesn't just happen. There's money going into it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think the point you're making is that if you were a man launching this in a different context, there wouldn't be a question about whether or not it was going to be, you know, funded or not, or business or not. And actually, there's something about women in kind of endeavouring to challenge societal norms in the way that you are with the platform that can bring that kind of criticism from other women and other men. But I think you just do what you do and you push through, because that is what you do and you will continue to do that. And I guess the point about this is that, you know, it isn't enough just to talk about this.
Exactly. What's the point of just having some conferences and nothing happens? We need to have a platform where we can build things, right? And that needs money.
But I think that, you know, these things have to go in parallel with other kinds of ways of creating diversity and in creating inclusion and ultimately, equality. Because, you know, we've been talking about this stuff for a very long time. Now, we, you know, if you think, there was a piece over the weekend about the first female founding partner in the Magic Circle, which is the, you know, the most kind of prestigious law firms in the UK. Taken 30 years for the first female to be appointed in that level of seniority within that most rarefied group. You know, the kind of, that's like meant to be the kind of, you know, the top companies. So you don't get to plough your own furrow in the way that you do, because you have to work within the strictures of those companies. And for those women in those organisations, or, you know, those people from, you know, different ethnic groups, that is incredibly challenging. So I guess alongside what you're doing, I believe that we also have to find other mechanisms for sort of proving the benefits of diversity. Women are 50% of the population, and we're still talking about women.
53 or 54
Well, there you go. Yeah. And we're still having this discussion as though women are a minority group. You know, it's like, hang on a minute.
This is actually, you know, a very...
It's just extraordinary, isn't it?
People, women are always treated as a niche market. But it's like...
Yeah.
If it's a niche market, then it's a huge niche market,
yes,
right?
Yes,
so,
yes, exactly.
So who is going to tap into that market? I think the best people who should tap into that market are women themselves.
Yes.
Because they know the needs of other women and they can, you know, create businesses. But I really hope that, you know, through maybe these discussions that I can explain to people that, you know, you have to back women when they try to build things like this, you know, when they try to create infrastructures to help other women. You otherwise, you know, if we expect women's endeavors to be non-profit, we are never going to make the kind of impact that's going to be able to compete. So there's so much I can talk to you about forever, and I'm sure we'll have you again. But let's talk about COVID, because people are like, okay, with COVID, people working from home, so that should technically maybe benefit women, and the flexible working is more acceptable. But you were mentioning to me before we started recording that actually this is having a negative impact on women. So tell me about that.
Well, I think it's not as simple as it may sound. So when we did the conference, and one of the things that I talked about was really part of, you know, this is an ongoing campaign that's been, you know, that people have been talking about for a long time, which is around flexible working. So, you know, being able to work flexibly, primarily as a result of having children, has always been viewed very much as a kind of women's issue. You know, it's a female issue, it's women's issue. It isn't a female issue, it isn't a women's issue, it's a family issue, or it's a societal issue. It's much, much more than just kind of pigeonholing it again as a minority issue, given that it's 50% of the population. But actually, and that, there are people, I mean, Anna Whitehouse, who has a website and also has, you know, her own platform as Mother Pucker. She's been campaigning around this with her campaign, which is called Flex Appeal, for many, many years. So this isn't new. The campaigning and the kind of narrative around the benefits it can bring have been, you know, well documented. I guess my hope was within the COVID period, one of the benefits of that could be that for a lot of organisations that still really resisted this idea of flexible working, flexible could be, you know, working from home, flexible could be actually just working from lots of different locations, agile working, whatever you want to call it. There are still a lot of organisations that put a lot of weight around presenteeism, you know, being seen to be, you know, in the office for an amount of time, all of those sorts of strictures. Now, whilst that was breaking down, what COVID has done, as it's accelerated any of those kind of concerns about flexibility, because, you know, for a huge sector of the population, they've had to work from home. There hasn't been a choice, and it's been proven that it's possible. So that's really good. There are lots of negatives around that as well that I think we're beginning to understand better, not least of which is that, you know, the kinds of gender biases around domestic responsibilities for both childcare and just kind of home stuff that are still predominantly female, even if both partners or, you know, both people are working for the same amount of time, you know, or with equivalent roles, has in many instances been kind of exaggerated even further. So there is an increasing amount of data now around the impact of that home working with the loss of childcare, with the loss of school, on women and on women's ability to continue their jobs, or that they have actually found they've been even further sidelined as a result of all of this. And so there's a survey actually that's just been done by Pregnant Then Screwed, which is a campaigning group for women, kind of says it on the tin, really, I don't need to explain. About 20,000 women who had lost their jobs over the lockdown period, that they, and of those, you know, of those women, an incredibly high statistic, it was about like 81%, said that actually there was a relationship between the loss of their job being made redundant and childcare issues. Three-fifths of all domestic, if you look at this more university, three-fifths of kind of domestic work is done by women. So well over half of the childcare kind of needs, you know, well over 50% of all childcare is performed by women versus any other things that have to go on within relationships. So this is not, so the kind of equity within that gender, you know, those gender roles, or the inequity, I should say, has been greatly exaggerated actually over this COVID period. So I think there are very positive things about a proof that, you know, more flexible working can happen and is possible, and it should be available for men and women, but also that actually the impact of that domestic, that inherent domestic imbalance, and the amount of responsibility women still take for children and home has really been exposed to its kind of, you know, full degree. So where does that take us? Well, I think that what we have to look for really is an opportunity to really celebrate, you know, the kind of the positives, but also we need to just fight even harder for what women need in order to continue their careers. A lot of that is around childcare. A lot of that is around access to affordable childcare. When you look at other countries in Europe where you have a much higher percentage of women reaching those senior positions, the Nordic countries particularly, if you look at Sweden, if you look at Scandinavia, look at Sweden, you look at Denmark, you know, what they have at a baseline is a much, much better equipped childcare system from a much earlier age. So you create, you take out the inequity of child cost and childcare that then falls naturally on women's shoulders, and it just enables a larger percentage of women to get into the funnel, to move up the, you know, the tree. The other side of it, though, that I think is positive that's come out of this COVID is that there are also now a larger group of men, I think, who have seen the benefits of working in a different way, have seen the benefits of less commuting, have seen the benefits of spending more time at home with their partners or their wives or their children or whomever. And, you know, for that group, you know, they are then, they've got a different motivation, you know, for continuing the change or making the change happen. And that is positive for women as well, because actually, you know, you need men on the journey. So it isn't really, I don't have a, you know, I don't have an answer. I think all this is about watching, you know, the evolution of the workplace. And, you know, when it comes full circle back to technology, which is the base and the root of really, you know, your area of expertise, then that has enabled this to happen. It will continue to help us to make these changes. And that is also implicit within changes within, you know, the kind of wider organizations, really just through the understanding of how data in particular, you know, really understanding the data and understanding what companies, you know, what the reality is behind the kind of sound bites around this. You know, there's one thing, the company saying it's trying to do something. There's a very different thing when you actually look at the reality. I take you back to the example of the magic circle and, you know, the evolution of women reaching senior positions, you know, in the legal field, you know.
The issue, Justine, is that majority of the roles that are disappearing, you know, tasks that are disappearing, are those of women's, because they've had historically more kind of repetitive tasks, right? So that's so in a way, COVID-19 has made it easier for companies to let go of a lot of women, because of, you know, basically COVID-19 has been like a great excuse to accelerate something that was coming down the line anyway. And in reality, I think the way to get around it is for women to become more well-versed in technology and to create new industries. Because a lot of those industries are already in trouble, and we need mm-hmm. to create new ways of creating value. And that has to come from women, because, you know, they are going to be most affected. And I think if women want to have that sense of, career achievement mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. generally, you know, making progress, having a higher socioeconomic status, that's got to come from within a female circle, in a way, you know, because...
Well, it has to be both, doesn't it? Because the kind of groups I'm talking about aren't necessarily the groups that are directly affected by volume in the way that you're talking. So these are professional women. These are women who are in roles within organisations where, you know, they are, you know, they're educated and they are on a career path within organisations. I'm not really talking necessarily about those that are most impacted, like, in retail or in, you know, the areas that have lost thousands, you know. And you're right, a lot of that is affecting, you know, is very much affecting women, working women, you know. I agree, but it isn't, you know, women and... what you're doing is trying to get women to help other women, but this still remains, you're still then risking creating it doesn't help us to also address the intrinsic issues that exist around the basic gender equality that comes from women being the ones that have children, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the base level, isn't it?
Yeah,
until we
yeah.
stop having children, which I don't think women are going to do.
Okay, you just opened a can of worms there, because you know my views on that.
I don't disagree enough when I look at some of the women who I know who are in the most senior roles within the businesses they inhabit, either their own businesses or organisations. Quite a large percentage of those don't have children. So, you know, and I think there is undoubtedly a correlation. If a woman does not want to have children and you make a choice about that, and that is an active choice, then that should be as worthy of, you know, respect and celebration as a woman choosing to have children. And your point about women feeling pressurized to have children because they're with a partner that wants them to have children, absolutely, completely agree. So there shouldn't be any kind of stigma attached to women who choose not to have children, you know, which is kind of the point you're making. But actually, that's not the same as saying that in order to have children, you kind of have to, you know, you have to be looking after them all the time, because that was also not necessarily the best care of a child.
One of the issues here is, like, it's a question of, can you have it all? And I just don't think you can have it all.
No, I think, and
right?
I would question what have it all is.
So, like, say, because when we talk about the fact that there are not enough women in the top tier of society,
yeah.
right,
yeah.
that's have it all. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Like yeah. Why don't we have female Ray Dalios, you know, like that mm-hmm. kind of thing, right?
Well, because he's come up through a male network to get to the point he's in. It starts much lower down the
line. But do you think that for a woman who has kids, it is possible. I think it will be very, very hard, much, much harder.
Yeah, but you have to make a choice about how you spend your time. So if you choose, so, you know, it, and that does come into the kind of childcare you have access to. That does come to, you know, the way that you work your relationship and whether you choose, you know, how you choose. And I would question the terminology, have it all. What is have it all? Have it all is what, you know, being singularly focused on, you know, making money on your career. You know, it's a kind of, It's a qualification.
When you think about the fact that the world is run by 10 men.
Yes, you know, well, right? Yeah.
There's not one single woman in that picture. What I'm talking about is like women being in that position. Like, you know, like half of those people should be women. That and what does it take to do that? And I think it's really, really hard, if you know, with having children.
But the reason that those 10 men are in those positions in those organisations is it still comes out of the same male, you know, male enclaves for those new industries as have always existed in all of the kind of older industries that used to be the powerhouses, you know, that used to be shipping or it used to be banking or whatever those industries were. The principle, why that's happened and continues to happen is the same thing. You know, you have, you know, so you have your, you know, I'm not so concerned about your Ray Dalios, but, you know, your Jeff Bezoses and whoever else. Yeah, entrepreneurs that have existed in male, you know, male dominated arenas that have created male communities around them, have been supported by the male communities of investors, of all the people who are already in those power structures that have ever existed, have then supported them through into the roles that they now inhabit. It's no different than it would have been when you were talking about, you know, a great shipping magnate, you know, in the 19th century. You know, it's the same rationale.
So do you think that if we had those kinds of networks for women, they could have kids and still make it to those levels?
Well, if they were hungry enough and wanted it to that extent, they wouldn't have it all in the way that we're kind of bandying around this terminology in terms of, you know, having what, you know, work-life balance, whatever it's called, which I cannot bear as a phrase, to be honest, because, you know, I don't think anyone has that, to be honest, in a way that it's kind of what that phrase means. But it's about, yeah, you know, it is about making choices. It's about where you spend your time. But it doesn't mean to say that if you pursue a career and want to really kind of, you know, travel right the way up a particular career path, you know, whatever that might be, as a woman, that you cannot have children. But it is undoubtedly the case, and it makes it more, you know, it's more challenging to do that. Yeah. I mean, I'm not fundamentally disagreeing with the point. I just think it's very, we have to be very careful about making statements about, you know, what the right and wrong ways of achieving that level of success.
Well, I as we bring this discussion to an end, all I would say to people listening is that ultimately anything I say here, you know, just take it with a pinch of salt, you know, and think about the fact that, first of all, it's just like one person's opinion at a certain, you know, time, point in time, right? But also, you shouldn't be dismissing, like, even if you disagree with me, you know, decision or my way of thinking, you know, I come from a very difficult background in, you know, in a very oppressive, you know, society. And I've had to be always kind of like in a fighting mode, right?
Yes,
to get to where I've gotten, right?
Yeah.
And maybe society needs all sorts of people. And maybe like the pain that I have gone through has now caused me to kind of be this sort of fighting character to maybe open up the way for some other women to have a more balanced life. You know, they don't I'm not suggesting that people should follow my lead in any way. You know, all I'm saying is like maybe some women have to take it to that extreme so that it changes on the balance, it changes the view point of society. My wish is to be able to see half of those people in those technology firms that are building, you know, that are basically running the world, at least half of them to be women and some of them to be women of color, because I feel like the world is basically run by 10 companies that are you know, male dominated. So,
male dominated. Yeah, no, I don't disagree. And I think the thing is, what you've done, what you've done already and what you are doing is exceptional. And what I would just say to that point is that we're talking very generalistically. You know, we're not talking about ourselves per se. We're talking kind of very generally about women, with some elements of our personal histories, you know, interspersed in there. And I think that there are exceptional men, and, you know, and there are exceptional women, and you are an exceptional woman. You are also a fantastic role model for women, because you are doing something that is really kind of pushing the boundaries of what, you know, what women are capable of. But you're also doing, you know, pushing the boundaries for, you know, for a lot of men as well, because, you know, so actually that you, you're an exceptional sort of human. And I know you always go, oh yeah, but that means that other people would say, oh, I can't do it because, you know.
I just feel like when we say somebody's exceptional, then it's hard to think of them as a role model, because if they're exceptional, then we think that we can't achieve that, right? So I mean, whereas I don't think I'm exceptional. I just think like, I just have, maybe I have exceptional drive.
You do.
You know, it's just a drive. But I'm
do.
Like, I'm not more intelligent. I'm not like more, you know, like I just
that's
think
exceptional. That's
I just have drive, and I don't know where that drive comes from. Like people always tell me, like I just don't know where it comes from. It's just there.
But you know, if you won't agree that other things about you are exceptional, that alone is exceptional, because it is a kind of singularity that a lot of people who are achieve great things, whether that's through, you know, science or technology or just generally in the world, have incredible singularity, you know, and the desire to pursue something, you know, for any reason is, you know, that is an exceptional quality. And a lot of people don't have that. And that's something to be celebrated. It's not something, you know, that's amazing. And that's still, you're still a role model. It doesn't matter whether or not people feel that they have that same level, because it's opening up examples and gateways for other, you know, women to be part of what you're doing, or to look at you and think, you know, that's great. You know, she's making a difference. So I hope so.
Because when I was growing up, you know, I felt like I didn't really have female role models, you know, like all of the people that I really liked in or loved, you know, like Nietzsche, you know, yeah, like people who really impacted me in business, in, you know, philosophy, science, you know, Carl Sagan, you know, like, and we talked about Carl Sagan last time, and I was talking to you about how, you know, his wife is, you know, out there and promoting still, and like talking about him with some amazing, you know, memories, and trying to keep his memory alive. But I just wish to live in a world where men are doing that for women too, you know. And recently I was listening to a podcast of Lex Fridman, and there was a gentleman who was talking about Ayn Rand, you know, the
So
and I was like, and he was like talking about her philosophy, and you know, and it was the first time maybe that I've heard a man talk about the philosophy of a woman in that sense, in that way. And I was like, you know, we really need more of that, because there, we talk about the fact that there are not enough role models in history for women, but actually there are. It's just that we don't talk about them, you know. They have been kind of forgotten, and I mentioned some of those in you know, the first conference. So I just really, yeah, I hope that, I mean, one thing I've realized is that when you put yourself out there and you talk about certain things, you cannot control how people react to it, you know, and ultimately, if it makes some people hate me, if it makes some people love me, I can't control that, you know. I have to be true to myself, and I just, I know that I have certain level of craziness, you know, and certain, you know, flavor of crazy, you know, and there are things that I wouldn't change in any way, you know, about myself, because, you know, it's what makes me who I am and makes me
driven,
you know.
So
I just hope that people keep an open mind and you know, take what's good, and anything you disagree, just disagree. But you know,
yeah,
like be kind.
but that's the point about having a dialogue, isn't it? That, you know, you can have different points of view. That's what a dialogue is. That's what, you know, and as you said at one point, you know, you can change your mind as well, you know, because that's the point, isn't it? That you don't have to, you know, actually the point is that we're not in an algorithm that's only ever going to serve us the same thing over and over and over and over again. You know, we have the ability to make different choices and listen to different, you know, different inputs, and we have to be really mindful of that and make sure we continue to do it, because the reality of, you know, is that that isn't happening out there right now for a lot of people. They only ever get one, they're only ever going to get one point of view that just continually reconfirms the thing they believe, you know, they believed in the first place, which is, you know, poisonous, actually, politically.
I think that the key is to keep an open mind and not judge someone based on one sentence, you know, or one, sometimes I say things to just, like, provoke a reaction. I'm like, let's consider, is it crazy? You know, like, what if, you know, it's kind of like just the what if moment. So thank you so much for joining today. And it's been great to have you on the platform, I'm sure, that and the conference. And I'm sure that we will talk again. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thanks, Somi.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or YouTube, and connect with me on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Instagram.